Accession number 28651, Mr. Victor Berwick, Reel 2. Now, we were talking about the operation of the Vickers Predictor. Now, you've described how you set it up now. You sighted a plane.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about training, but I mean, you sighted a plane. What do you do then? Right. Number one.
Well, once I got the predictor on the target, the two operators on the telescopes, one on the elevation and one on bearing, they will report on target. That's on in their telescope. And they will be then carrying on following the target in the telescope by using their traversing hand wheels. And so it just the predictor just move around all times on target. And they report on target. And we report to the... I report to the officer in charge. Because it'd be an officer in charge of the command post. One thing I did forget was later on in life I was promoted from number one to what's called the GPO ACK.
We'll come to that, don't worry.
Okay.
So what happens next then?
Yeah, so once you're on target, the predictor, the height finder, also would be getting onto the target. And they would immediately do. There were three men on the predictor, on the height finder, one in charge, and one on the elevation, one on bearing. But the one in charge, he had to also operate certain controls, which would then give him the height of the aircraft. And once he'd done that, that was all done through prisms on the height finder. Once he got that height out, he reported a height so-and-so. And that height was then fed into the predictor.
And then what?
We would carry on following the target. The height would be set in on two drums at the back of the predictor. Before that was something else. Just trying to think. There's another control.
It might
I ought to state something I've forgotten. But before you go into action, of course, everything had to be lined up, make sure you were facing the right direction. When you went onto a new site, you would decide on an aiming point. It might be a church spire, it might be something in the far distance. And so the command post would indicate to all concerned, aiming point so-and-so. And the guns would be swung round to that aiming point. And they... had a sight on the side of the gun, which where the number one of the gun would be on the aiming point, and then the predictor also would go onto the aiming point, and once that bearing was obtained, that bearing would be set in on the predictor on a special scale. So we then knew that guns and predictor were all on the same bearing, right? So the plane would be followed, and the height would be set in on what they called the fuse drum, which was rotating. The operator on the fuse drum and the elevation drum, they had to, that was, but the drums were rotating as part of the machinery, they had to keep a pointer on the height which had been set in, each of them. And by doing so, automatically, the correct fuse was then being transmitted from the fuse drum onto the fuse setter on the guns, and also the fact that the number six, who was on the elevation, he was making sure that the gun elevation was being maintained correctly. And the same drill of keeping a pointer on it was a big graph actually, on sort of graph paper with winding curves, and you had the point had to be kept on those curves, and that was making sure that the correct information was going through.
And this was operated by clockwork?
The whole machinery was, yes.
And that would that presumably have to be wound up first? Or
yes, there was a toggle running down the side. I think it was a toggle. There was an indicator which showed what state the actual mechanism was in, whether it was nearest end of its run or not. And it was the job of number one to make sure it was fully wound. It went for quite a long time, actually. It was a very, very powerful spring.
Could you actually wind it up in use?
Oh yes.
So while it was working?
Yes. Once the number one had done his job and the members, other members of the team were doing their job, well, then the number one really just had to make sure that everything was going correctly. So he had time on his hands to look after that winding up.
Now, were you selected as number one right from the start, or did you first train all the other jobs?
Yes, I was. I think mainly by a bit of nepotism, shall we say. Of course, I knew through my business connection of one of the original officers, and he thought that I was probably the right material.
Were you promoted straight away then to Lance Bombardier or something? Or Bombardier?
No. I did receive one stripe fairly early on. In fact, I was in charge of the predictor and then became Bombardier fairly quickly after that.
Now, what about, so you'd have training sessions late 30, well, almost 1939, then training, you had 9 months. I mean, would you go for weekend firing camps? What pattern? So
the training was only one evening a week, as far as I can remember.
So no weekend or annual camp?
Weekend, we did go out on aircraft identification.
Now tell us about that.
Yes. The first time we went out, we were taking the one gun and all the equipment, the predictor and the height finder, out to Great Chart on a very high piece of high ground, which is now a building site, where an aircraft had been laid on for us to practice on. And it would appear from any angle. We didn't know where it was coming from, but once we heard the noise of a plane, everybody would be on the qui vive as to where it was coming from, and we then go into action in the normal way. The height finder and the spotter, what we call the spotters, who are in charge of the telescope. And we go through our procedures there, or what we call dummy drill.
Practice?
No ammunition.
Now, what about the aircraft identification part of it?
We were given very good literature of all the German aircraft and of the British as well, because it is essential that you were able to identify aircraft very quickly from all angles. So that was something which I was very keen on.
Was there any way of practicing that? At that stage?
No, I don't think it's pretty basic. Well, nowadays, one, of course, would have a screen and a side be flashed up and you'd have to identify what it was. But we weren't that far ahead in those days. It was just learning by rote from the books. And then we had tests on it to say, what's this? And we'd have to say what aircraft it was, from a silhouette on a whole sheet of paper.
Now, any other aspects of the training during that first 9 months or so?
No, not really.
Did you go away on summer camp?
We didn't. We only had, roughly about 9 months to a year before the war broke out. So we had no training on with live ammunition at all. The first training camp we went to was after war was declared.
Now, tell me a bit about the other lads who were in your, how did you get on with them, the other ranks and lower?
Oh, it was a real mixed bag. There were quite a number of professional people like myself from the town. One was a doctor's son, and another was a chartered accountant. He's building trade. We had one chap who was from a gypsy background who used to bring Rose Hedgehog after weekend leave, which I tasted. Did become an addict for Rose Hedgehog. He used to call them Odgy Pigs, and apparently it was a gypsy name for a hedgehog. No, it's a real Mick.
And how did you get on? Because Mick
very well, yes. One of my great chaps, who was a sergeant, he was a milk roundsman, an Irishman, named O'Connor, and I got on very well with him.
So you weren't just friends with the people from your own background or professional
Well, yes,
you got on with a lot of them.
Yes, we had bank clerks, and we had a real mix. It was great.
Who was your sergeant? Was he a figure that stood out in your mind?
Well, the original sergeants were, there was one who was an ex-infantryman. He was a gunner. He served in the army, and he was an Irishman, Mickey Mullen. Another sergeant was a young milkman. He became a sergeant, Jack O'Connor. He's not Irish.
What were they like?
Very outgoing, very good, good fun.
Good sergeants?
Yes.
Did they know their stuff? I mean,
well, they were all rookies like I was. We did have some rankers who had been in the Royal Field Artillery. But not many. There weren't a great number who had army experience, really.
Now, who amongst the officers do you remember?
Yes, the actual CO of the battery was a Major Lamport, Major Basil Lamport, L-A-M-P-O-R-T.
What was he like?
He was nice chap. But
did you know him outside of the unit, or
no? I didn't. I knew of his family, but didn't really actually know him.
Which other officers do you remember?
The other officer was a Tony. Heavens!
All right.
No.
Who was the one who you knew?
Pairs of. P-A-R-E-S, Pairs. He ran a nursery up on the hill. He ran the regional officers. Another one was Pratt, P-R-A-T-T. He came from the Folkestone area. He was in the timber trade, he was, I remember. And
what were these officers like? I mean, were they good officers, were they?
They were all beginners like we were. They had to learn right from scratch. They weren't ex-army. I think Major Lambert might have had some previous army training, but the officers, the actual officers, were all started from scratch like we were.
Not many dugouts then from the First World War.
Oh no.
Now, so anything happened that you remember during your training before the war started?
Yes. Well, the first. First incident was on that exercise when we went to Great Chart. We were transferred out there by buses, double-decker buses, East Kent. And so I was in the leading bus going out via what's called Chart Road from Ashford, and from Ashford High Street. And it went under a railway bridge. And the bus was too high for the railway bridge. I was in the front seat on the top deck and suddenly saw this bridge looming. And three or four of us, we were on the floor because it crashed. The roof of the bus just hit the bridge. Luckily, it wasn't going too fast and they were able to reverse out. But and that was the first war experience.
Were you expecting war to break out? I mean, did you? I mean,
no. Right, it came very suddenly because it came on a weekday morning. I was in the office in Bank Street, and a big chap who was the gun fitter. He was in charge of a local garage, and he was our gun fitter. We also had to have a fitter to do odd repairs on guns and so forth. And he breezed into the office and gave me a blue form. He said, "We've been called up, and report to so and so." I think it was down the builder's yard, North Street, that afternoon. So I went home and had lunch and down towards in the office, and that was it.
And this is August, late August.
Yes, yes.
And what were your reactions to this? I mean,
a bit shattering, leaving the job, and I was married at the time, so I went home, told the wife at lunchtime, and reported, and we were...
What did the wife think? I mean,
oh, she was a bit shattered too. But we had no family at the time. We were both just the two of us. Because I was married in 1936, 10th of April.
What did your employer think?
Well, funnily enough, the junior partner of the firm, Anthony Gearing, he was also one of us. He joined the battery, you see. So he had the down tools as well. As well as one of the height finders, Reg Ratton, he was also part of the firm. He had to go. So it rather hit the firm very severely, because apart from the artillery, we had three other younger members of the staff who were in the local Royal Army Medical Corps unit. So it really decimated the staff.
Now, so what happened when you went home for lunch,
yep,
and then to the building, to North Street?
And we were issued straight away with the dungarees outfit that we had.
Now, had you still only just had the denim, or had you actually got a proper uniform?
No, we just had the denim, that's right. We didn't have a proper uniform until some days later, I think. But it was quite quickly that we all measured up and fitted out with...
And what uniform did you get? Do you remember?
Just battle dress. Was the army battle dress.
Nothing else?
We also were measured for a dress uniform, but not the full dress, but a khaki tunic, as they call it. Tunic and proper trousers.
And what else was happening? I mean, what was there anywhere to sleep or anything at North Street?
No, went home. No. We just went home and reported every morning.
And what were you doing when you reported?
We were training. It's full training after that point. But also, in my notes, you'll see that I was sent in charge of a small detachment to Dunkirk, which is between... Faversham and Canterbury, where there was a big radar station.
Now, is this before the war broke out?
No, this is after the war broke out.
What about the day war broke out? It's the old joke. What do you remember of the day war broke out?
Well, I just told you that it was... I was in the office and...
No, but that's when you called up.
Sorry, beg your pardon. Yes, of course.
The Sunday the 3rd of...
Yeah.
You may not remember.
I don't remember. No. Now, of course, we were moving around then. It could have been when we were up at Horton Kirby in North Kent.
Now, tell me what happened when you went on this detachment. Now, this is to the Dunkirk.
Yeah, we went on detachment. They're building defence positions around the radar station. In other words, digging trenches and lining them with sandbags and so forth against any ground attack.
And what type of trenches were you digging? How big a system was it?
They were called slit trenches, which roughly, I suppose, could have been 12 feet long and not too deep, deep enough to stand in and to get enough cover with sandbags on the banks.
And anything else you were doing, or was it just a digging job?
It was a digging job. We went up there several days doing that by bus. And I was in charge of, as I had a stripe, I was in charge of of the squad. One thing I do remember, I don't even want to make a note of this, but it could be, you can delete it if you wish. Knowing that I was an office worker, you see, in my squad I had several builders and navvies and people who had been used to a lot of hard graft. And so they said, when we started, they said, "Look, Bombardier," said, "you're going to get a lot of blisters on your hands. Our hands are used to it. Even so, we're going to take appropriate action." I said, "What's that?" He said, "We pee on our hands." And so probably urinated on their hands and let it dry. And it hardens the skin. And it worked too.
Now, so how long were you doing this for? Just a few days?
A few days. Yes, we were then called to go to Horton Kirby in North Kent near Dartford, where we took over 8 guns there.
Horton Kirby? How did
Horton, 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 Kirby, Kirby.
And that's near where?
Near Dartford.
Now, was this your first base then?
That was the first time we had any proper guns. They were 3.7s.
And you went there in October, according to your notes, would
yeah,
that be right?
Yes, about that. Hmm.
And tell us about the 3.7s. This is a big step up, because they're a proper...
Yes, we... I'm just trying to think how we... That's right, we went straight into training on the 3.7s, because we hadn't seen them. We knew all of them. But so we had proper instructors who were proficient on the 3.7s, and we quickly got to know how to operate them. Well, the basic operation is just the same, actually, except that they've got the greater range and a proper, what they call, semi-automatic breech. The 3-inch breech was a screw breech, which was very slow in action. A, you had, first of all, a loader. He was a chap who rammed the actual round, which was a fixed round. Which, when I say fixed, it had a brass large cartridge filled with propellant, and then the actual explosive round on the end, like a very large bullet, in other words, according to the round, instead of an ordinary rifle round. That was rammed home by the loader, and then you had a separate breech operator. And being a screw breech, he had to slam the breech to and lock it, and then twist it. The locking and the twisting all in one motion. And it was a threaded screw which fitted into the actual thread of the breech, and that locked it. And directly the breech was locked, he also did the firing.
Now, how did the 3.7 work in contrast?
Now, the 3.7 had a vocal sliding breech, which operated from left to right. And being semi-automatic, it had a spring action. So the breech was always open. Directly around had been fired, the breech opened automatically and was held open by special springs and two clips. Directly the round was rammed home, because the loader actually also had a big leather glove in ramming to save his hands, and rammed home, that pushed these what they call retaining clips forward. The springs came to action, and the breech shot across, knocked his hand out sideways, and so the breech was locked automatically and fired.
Obviously a much better gun. I presume it was much more range and elevation.
I forget the range of the three inch, but we had ground range. You had a 22,000 yard range on a ground target, but not quite so high if one was firing upwards. But we got up to 32,000 feet was the most that we could go to. That was only very seldom would we ever be able to maintain that. Of course, the aircraft would be out of range in no time.
Did you get 8 of these, or I mean,
8,
the full thing?
8 for a battery. Yeah.
Now, what was the gun positions, how were they laid out at Houghton Kirby? Because this would be your first real gun positions, weren't it?
Could you
sort of describe the layout where the command post, where the guns were?
First of all, you got your the actual installation you were protecting.
What was that?
Vickers Armstrong works, where the predictions were made. Same place, yeah. And so normally you did, or at least it would be decided by the powers that be, the CO, or maybe from high command, that a likely point of attack might be from a certain bearing. In that case, it would be across the channel, wouldn't it? Be from the southeast. So you'd have one troop facing outwards for any oncoming aircraft that way, and then normally you would have the other troop facing outwards on at the 180 degree, right, straight across. So there's your projecting point, one range of guns, another that way. But it doesn't follow it always be that way. It depends on circumstances.
And what was the actual command post, the predictor station, and the gun position? What did it actually look like? I mean, well, how dug in were you?
We weren't dug in normally. Not to, the guns were never dug in. They had to be on a very firm base, because you see the guns had to be levelled, the same as the predictor. Everything had to be levelled, so the information given was going to be fed into the right source. And so you always chose a very firm ground on which the guns were put down. And likewise with the predictor and the height finder, they had to be on firm ground, even with their tripods. The guns were never dug in, they sat, but sandbagged round.
How high? Roughly.
Well, shoulder height.
Shoulder height, so yeah. which on you is, what, 5 or 6 feet?
Yeah, right? Yes. Because then inside that you had all the ammunition supply, right round the whole of the... You had a gateway into the gun enclosure. And then sandbags right the way around. And then the ammunition would be round in big metal boxes. Only one round to a box, because it was pretty heavy. They would be spread around.
And so they'd be...
A number of the rounds would have the fuse caps taken off. Each fuse cap had a protective casing over it, which would just flipped off.
Now... Would these be in a line or higgledy-piggledy or...?
No, they'd be round in an arc. A man could get down and pick one up. And of course, with 4.5, so a half a hundredweight.
Oh, these are 3.7s.
The 3.7s, yes.
But sorry, when I meant... I see what you mean. But I meant the actual... Each gun position.
Oh,
would
no,
they be
no.
in a straight... Hang on, you're attached.
Right. Yeah. Oh. No. Right, you have the four guns like in an arc, and the distance between each gun would be not great, but enough to give a spread, because by having too much of an arc, you were going to upset the actual. And there was part of the drill that the fact that the four guns were going to be on one target. And they'd all aimed on the aiming point from a different position. That was all corrected by an adjustment on the dial. I forget what the term was, but it made sure that they were firing not actually on one point, but in a straight line. So it gave, if one gun missed, there's more chance that the other three would hit the target.